Across the world, the late 18th century was a dramatic era. Upstart empires clashed, kings rose and fell. In South Asia, the glory days of the Mughal emperors were fading. Ambitious newcomers were preparing to seize power, changing the political map forever. Enter the legendary Maharaja Ranjit Singh, known as the Lion of the Punjab. In 1799, he captured the city of Lahore, now in Pakistan. The Sikh empire he created stretched all the way from the snowy peaks of the Himalayas to the deserts of Sindh, taking in large parts of what's now India, Pakistan, Kashmir, Afghanistan, and Tibet. But how did one royal family come to achieve such preeminence over this entire region? Welcome to Afterwords. I'm Alex von Tunzelman, historian, screenwriter and author. And today I have the huge privilege to be joined by Priya Atwal, Community History Fellow at the University of Oxford, author and historical consultant. Her dazzling book, Royals and Rebels, The Rise and Fall of the Sikh Empire, sheds new light on the forgotten men and women, from royalty to servants who played their parts in the spectacular rise and arguably spectacular demise of the extraordinary Sikh Empire. Priya, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to be talking to you.
Thanks, Alex. What an introduction.
Well, you wrote the book. I mean, and the first thing I want to say is just to congratulate you on writing such a totally gripping book. So I was completely hooked by page 5, by the story of Ranjit Singh's last wife, Maharani Jind Kaur, which I'm sure we'll come to speak about later on. Really amazing story. And I think this started out as a biography of her, actually, before you broadened the story.
Very much so. I was equally gripped by her story as an undergraduate student. Definitely set out with the intention of writing solely about her, but through the course of a PhD, realised that there were many other queens that had been, you know, lying in wait for their stories to be discovered, and that there was an army of women behind Jind Kaur who also needed to be written about, really, and to put her story into context too. So this is really what this book was all about.
So, I mean, obviously the story of the Sikh Empire is enormously important to Sikhs everywhere all over the world today, and it's a huge part of the history of the subcontinent. But for listeners in the UK as well, I think it's a really vital part of understanding British history, because the period that of the Sikh Empire, the kind of high period of it, really collided with the history of the British Empire in India. And again, I'm sure we'll come back to discussing that
Absolutely.
At the end as well. But and of course, you know, the seeds have famous wars and all that, but many of us in Britain really learn very little about this history. So is that something that you're kind of here to put right a little bit?
There's kind of two sides to that, in a way, that I wanted to play with my research and with this book. One is looking at some of the elements of contingency in South Asian history at that point in time, that you have all of these different new powers, new upstart kings and queens and powers like the East India Company and other European trading companies that are all scrambling for authority and territory in South Asia during this real period of flux, but also how these new royal elites that come into play, you know, from the ashes of the Mughal Empire across South Asia, are working to carve new places for themselves. And how, you know, something I looked at with my PhD, which was obviously where this book sprung from, is actually even where British royalty were making a stake into all of this as well. But where I ended up crystallizing the contents of this book is really focusing in on the Punjabi royal family and looking at the dynamics of their imperialism, their empire building in the north of South Asia. So what is today split pretty evenly between India and Pakistan, the Punjab region, and how they rose to power and how they were so creative about displaying that power, and really how they went toe to toe with the East India Company in making that happen, relying on them as allies to rise, but then also clashing with them brutally in the fall.
Absolutely. Now, fairy tales often end with a wedding. That's how we're often used to hearing stories. And you open Royals and Rebels with a lavish scene of what you call the ultimate wedding to end all weddings in Punjabi history. Now, anyone who knows Punjabi history at all will be very excited about just how bling this wedding is, I think. And it was the ceremony for the first marriage of Prince Nau Nihal Singh, which was held in 1837. So tell us about that wedding. Why was it so significant?
Well, I'll shine a little light on what inspired that, actually, because, you know, I was thinking, how do I introduce this cast of, you know, this massive Punjabi family and a royal family and We were actually planning the engagement party for my brother, who just got engaged, and which is called a rokka in Punjabi. And also my cousin was getting married. And so it was full on wedding fever in our house, you know, trips back and forth to Southall, Birmingham, you know, getting bits and pieces together. And you just couldn't escape it. And I was thinking, you know, that weddings are such a huge moment for celebration, but they're also kind of key moments of diplomacy, you know, when you need all of the in-laws, all of the different members, whether it's in your family or the bride or groom's family, to get along. And it's a big moment for display and pride and that kind of stuff. So I don't know, it just slapped me in the face to say this is the ultimate way to introduce this. But it was there in the sources time and time again, how the Maharaja Ranjit Singh used weddings as important moments of diplomacy in really putting his newfound dynasty on display. And the guest list that you had at the wedding of his grandson, Prince Noor Nihal Singh, who was the son of his eldest son and heir to the throne, Gorakh Singh, it was just massive. It really was the who's who of all of Northern Indian elite society that was present and giving gifts and coming on their elephants and all the rest of it. And it was just the best way to give an insight into the power of the Punjabi royal family at its peak, right? And the fact that it wasn't just exclusively a Sikh ruling family, it had Hindu and Muslim women in there as well. It was very cosmopolitan and willing to make links with European elites too. They also knew how to throw an absolutely massive party. So, you know, it had to be done.
Coming back to the sort of incredible period that you described in sort of late 18th, early 19th century, as you say, very febrile time on the Indian subcontinent, lots of change, lots of competition, lots of opportunity. I mean, it's a time when sort of, you know, everything's to play for, really. So why was this kind of such a volatile moment in Indian history and then specifically in Sikh political culture as well?
So there's two ways of looking at this. It is volatile because the sort of stability of the Mughal Empire is breaking down. You enter into a new phase. But if you look at it from the lens of British colonial history of this period, it's really painted as this era of chaos and anarchy that the British therefore come in to step into to calm down and bring, you know, law and order and civilization to. But really, it's a fascinatingly creative era as well, where you've got all sorts of different new political figures coming through from the 18th century into the mid 19th century. And we're talking, you know, not just people like Maharaja Ranjit Singh, but before him, the 10 Sikh gurus, particularly Guru Gobind Singh, creating the Khalsa, the egalitarian Sikh brotherhood of warriors. Then, you know, in other parts of the subcontinent, you've had Tipu Sultan, the Begums of Bhopal, Begum Samaru, you know, other very amazing South Asian women, and the Avid dynasty, all kind of breaking away from the Mughal imperium, but refashioning its courtly culture and its regional politics in different kinds of ways. And in the Punjab, you have from the 18th century into the 19th, it's a really difficult time. The Sikhs in particular face ravages from Afghan invasions repeatedly, you know, where there's massacres and pillaging and intense persecution, but they also manage to build themselves up as a significantly powerful little polity. You know, that this is a period where the Sikhs engage in guerrilla warfare and build themselves up through the missile system, which was a series of at least 12 warrior bands, if not more, that our understanding of how they operated is really changing. And how Sikhs essentially, bit by bit, in this piecemeal kind of way, managed to establish small power bases throughout the region of the Punjab and consolidate themselves to fight off external invaders like the Afghans or others, but gradually set up themselves in little mini fiefdoms and really experiment with the kind of political legacies and the spiritual legacies that the gurus, the 10 spiritual masters of the Sikh faith, had left them with. And, you know, it's a time of precarity, but it's also fascinating how new ideas of kingship and of military organization and of social formation are all being experimented with in this way. And it plays out in some really, really rich ways. They set themselves off as mini kings, and Ranjit Singh then, in a way, unites all of this with his dynasty. But it's also in an era where, you know, you see a new flourishing of Sikh arts and political thought. And we see that in the kind of illuminated manuscripts that are produced at that time, the artworks, the objects. So, you know, it really counteracts the idea that this was chaos. Even in the midst of this new era of flux, there's some amazing stuff going on. And that all creates this bedrock of opportunity that the young Maharaja Ranjit Singh comes and exploits, really.
And he was so young. I mean, this is something I found very striking. We should talk a bit about Ranjit Singh just because he's such an incredible character in history. I mean, he became chief of this missile, this kind of warrior group that he was part of when he was just 12.
Yes. So you have these different warrior bands that were initially set up by the last of the 10 Gurus, Guru Gobind Singh, as kind of military units of the Sikh community, and men and women could equally participate in them as soldiers. And what we see also is that women in the 18th century become leaders of some of these groups, right? And Ranjit Singh's father, Maha Singh Sukrajakia, was one of the leaders of one of the smaller warrior bands, you could say, at the time, in the mid to late 18th century. But he dies really young in a kind of a freak accident. His gun backfires. And Ranjit Singh is only a young boy himself at that time when his father passes away. So control of the missile passes to his mother, Raj Gaur, for the time being. And she's a very capable woman. She governs everything, the small amount of territory that they have in the northwest of Punjab around Gujranwala, which is, funnily enough, where the current Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's family originated from. So something in the water over there. But Ranjit Singh really takes charge of things in his late teens, and he's 19 when he is invited to invade Lahore by many of the Muslim bankers and artisans and traders in the city, because it's previously under control by several Sikh chiefs, but they're not happy with the way that they're administering the city. And, you know, considering that Ranjit Singh was just a teenager, it's quite fascinating that he's invited in quite so early on in his career to take over this major, you know, former Mughal capital of the Punjab, to be quite honest. And that becomes his power base. But he couldn't have done it without his mum or his mother-in-law, to be quite honest, who invades the city with him.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the kind of amazing thing, is women are just kind of on the front line for this story, and sometimes quite literally. Can you just introduce us to a couple of these women? I mean, you've talked about his mother-in-law, but, like, you know, his wife is somebody also that I really want to talk about. Well, his last wife. But, I mean, introduce us to some of these amazing women from this period.
So there really were quite a few of these amazing women. I mean, I tried to put together, through the course of my research, I ended up having to put together, I should be honest, a spreadsheet with all of their names and as much of the information that I could glean. And that's now made its way into the appendix of the book. I've given a list of all of the wives of Ranjit Singh, as well as of his sons and their origins, mainly because I wanted to make that information available to collate the names and details of these women for the first time in one place and publish it so that others could hopefully dig into their stories more. But Ranjit Singh alone had at least 30 wives. His mother, Raj Gaur, was the leader of the Sukrajakya missile while he was a young boy. And then his mother-in-law from his first marriage, Sada Gaur, was the leader of a neighbouring missile, the Kanhaiya missile. And these two women are phenomenal just in their own right, because, you know, before Ranjit Singh's marriage was arranged with Sada Gaur's daughter, the two families had been at war with one another for several years. And actually, Ranjit Singh's father was culpable for the death of Sada Gaur's husband. So Ranjit Singh's father-in-law, he died in battle fighting against the Sukrajakyas. So for these two women to set aside that kind of enmity when both of their men had died and to arrange a marriage, you know, to unite their two households was amazing and very far-sighted if you think about it, right? But at the same time, these were political acts that these women were engaging in time and time again. And Ranjit Singh, during the course of his life, as I said, married over 30 women, not just for fun. it's not, you know, this is something important that I wanted to make as a point with this book. It's not this whole idea of this oriental harem where the Maharaja just amasses women for his own pleasure, or this sexually debauched idea. We don't know if he really actually had very interpersonal relationships with many of these women. What we can see from the historical record is that these were imperial marriages that kind of mirrored what earlier Mughal emperors had perhaps done, like Akbar, for example, that enabled him to actually displace his mother-in-law, who is a very powerful figure, by building his network outwards and making ties with all sorts of other regional families as his empire was expanding from the northwest of Punjab and taking over the entire region. And so these women started to make a path for themselves within this newly emerging dynasty. And you had all sorts, really. The first few marriages were with quite elite Sikh women. But later on, we know that Ranjit Singh had love marriages with two Muslim former courtesans and dancing girls. First is Rani Mora, who was from Amritsar, and then later on was Maharani Gul Begum. And, you know, he gets in trouble with the Sikh authorities for trying to marry these women and you know, romance them publicly. But for Mora to Gul Begum, you see his power shifting, really, because Mora, he does get in trouble for quite significantly. But by the time that he's married to Gul Begum, no one's willing to question him. And all of these women had their own land. They had their multiple households that they could go and live in and move between. They didn't all just live at Lahore in a palace in seclusion. Much like Sadakor, some of them were leading troops. Those that had sons, particularly Ranjit Singh's second wife, Maina Gen, who was the mother of Garak Singh and the grandmother to Nonihal Singh, who had the massive wedding. She, you know, had her own fort. She was participating in battles and sending cannonballs to the front line and really educating her son to be the next Maharaja. So by the time you get to the last queen, Jind Kaur, who was actually from a very lowly Sikh background, she was the daughter of Ranjit Singh's kennel keeper. This is what fascinated me. She was the Maharani who defended the Sikh empire against the British in the last decade of its lifetime. And the British look at her to say, hang on, why is this woman in charge of this kingdom when her young son, Dalip Singh, the last Maharaja, is put on the throne? And really, you have just takes a few looks into these chronicles of this time and you realize actually the women had been running the show for a long time. It was only natural that Jind Kaur should take over in the 1840s.
I mean, I think that's so crucial. And it's because, you know, you do get this sense when you read older histories, I do think it's changing. This kind of stuff, domestic stuff, is trivial, that it's not really central to the story, that these affairs, these weddings and things, like, whatever. But as you say, actually, they're a really crucial part of the imperialism that was going on. They're a huge part of his network, his conquest, his power, are these marriages and these relationships and the women that they bring into his world.
Absolutely. I mean, look, do we just need to look at the furore over the royal weddings that we've had in this country in the past few years, right? Look at what it meant for Harry to marry Meghan Markle. and if it goes wrong, it goes really badly wrong, doesn't it? If you don't manage that family relationship very well. But this Punjabi royal family were adept at managing those relationships. And it's not to say that they weren't without their own tensions. You know, I mean, I talk about in one of the chapters that there's one Maharani who comes from a very elite, ancient, aristocratic Rajput family in the hills of Punjab. And she is so upset when she's bracketed with, in terms of looks and status, with Ranjit Singh's first Muslim wife, the dancing girl Mora, that she commits suicide. She sees it as such a dishonor that she's been not looked upon as favorably as her when Ranjit Singh is asked to choose his most beautiful, most favorite wife, that she kills herself. And Ranjit Singh thereafter never, ever offers an opinion of which wife is his favorite or which is the most important to him, because he knows, you know, that he pays the ultimate price. And so there was not just the kind of personal politics at stake. It was the fact that the families that he married into, whether they were high or low, they were crucial for maintaining his power, his reputation, and that of his lineage in all these different pockets of the kingdom. And of then building local alliances, right? But also then bringing in new talent, new people, new communities into his armed forces, into his administration and all the rest of it. None of this family knew whether their dynasty would survive beyond the next generation. So they're all hard at it to ensure that this continues. And I think you see that as a theme throughout the subcontinent in this period of time. So when you have an occasion like a Nonihal Singh massive wedding, this is a cause for celebration. Ranjit Singh himself knew that his ancestors, his dad, his granddad, and others before him hadn't even lived as long as he had lived because they died in battle or something else, let alone surviving to see your second or third generation reaching new heights and inviting the East India Company to celebrate with you, you know? If we bring some of that lived reality back into action as much as possible, which we see in such a rich way in these supposedly domestic spaces, You know, it brings, I think, the humanity back to that history and that political history particularly.
Completely agree. And I mean, that's the thing your book does absolutely wonderfully is exactly that. But I mean, when we're looking at how Ranjit Singh built this Sikh empire, it wasn't just weddings, was it? No. I mean, there's quite a lot of conquest and, as you say, and strategic alliances with people like the East India Company and, you know, bits of engagement. So, I mean, it was an enormous empire that he built. So how did that happen, as beyond just these marriage alliances and all of this?
With lots of fighting, lots of battles, plenty of it. I mean, there's actually a huge technological revolution that takes place in the Punjab at this time, with particularly in relation to the military. Ranjit Singh and his family members are engaged in learning more about European styles of military production, as well as what other South Asian rulers are doing, learning about new types of gunpowder, guns, cannons, military fortification, that kind of stuff. They're really interested in the sciences and the arts more generally, but there's also lots of very careful diplomacy going on. And this is where the women and the princes of the family, from the princes from as young as six, are sent out, not just on battles as kind of nominal generals to learn the job from the age of six, but also to meet with regional elites in all sorts of different settings, you know. So we talked about weddings earlier, but even funerals and condolence visits with religious leaders or with other nobles, you know, members of the family would personally go and give gifts or pay their respects and that kind of stuff. And they also trained this really important corps of generals and ambassadors and courtiers who would travel all over the region, you know, and were reaching out eventually by the 1840s into sections of Afghanistan and Tibet, just to expand and fly the flag of this empire all over the region. And I think this is something we don't perhaps appreciate today, but this sense of Greater Punjab was massive compared to what we understand as Punjab today within the borders of India and Pakistan. It was a continually expanding region as well. If Ranjit Singh had had his way, he would have tried to expand all the way down to Delhi, to be quite honest. But the East India Company stopped that from happening.
other people had ideas about that.
Yeah.
Too.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and it's an incredibly, I think you sort of touched on it there, but just it's such a culturally diverse empire as well, isn't it? You know, religiously, linguistically, and all of that. And as you say, he sort of, you know, that continued. I mean, he didn't try to impose one way of being on that area at all.
No, absolutely. I mean, this is the other thing that we refer to today as the Sikh Empire. And that's partly because the government was run in the name of the Khalsa. It was known as the Sarkari Khalsa, which is the kind of unified body of the Sikhs that was established under Guru Gobind Singh in 1699. But actually, Sikhs then were still a minority community within the Punjab itself. They were probably third largest after Hindus and Muslims in the region. So the Maharaja had to rule, although he, you know, had the pressure on his shoulders as ruling as this kind of idealized Sikh king and being led by all sorts of political literature and ideas that had emerged in the Punjab amongst the Sikhs from the late 18th century onwards about what it meant to be a Sikh and a ruler. He also knew that he was ruling over a population in which his own religious community were a minority, and therefore he had to rule for all Punjabis rather than just the Sikhs. You know, and this also creates tension around him and his family and what they stood for in terms of their religion and their ethics, because he's really not a model Sikh in many respects. He was a raging alcoholic, you know, he clearly, you know, had multiple marriages, which is nowhere written in the Sikh faith that you should be doing, and many other things, to be quite honest. He was an all-round colourful character, but he clearly tried to live by the ethics of his faith in that he promoted religious tolerance, violence against subjects was stopped. He gave openly to all religious charities of all different backgrounds and recruited people from all different backgrounds, again, to work within his government and his administration and the army. I mean, including reaching out to Europeans who were formerly generals and soldiers of the Napoleonic army, just telling them that, look, you need to grow a beard in order to fit in, to be quite honest. It's not going to look good. No one's going to respect you without a beard.
So it looks super weird with no beard.
So that was it. It's a fascinating period of history in that respect. And that's, I think, why it's looked back in interesting ways, not just by Sikhs, but also by other communities, and particularly in Pakistan, because, you know, many of the buildings and the Gurdwara and the memorials to the the Sikh Raj are only there because local Pakistani people have kept them preserved, you know, and that was vital for me when I was doing this research, as having access to this kind of these kind of monuments and things or manuscripts that are, you know, were otherwise would have been lost to us, because people have managed to make that effort despite the borders being created in 1947.
So the Sikh Empire, actually, you know, this incredible institution that was built by Ranjit Singh, and then he died, I think, in 1839. It only lasted for about 50 years in total. Why did it fall? What happened after he died, and who else came into the picture?
Well, the throne passes to his eldest son, Gurlukh Singh. And this is where the story becomes kind of mired in conspiracy theories and mythology and all this kind of stuff, which I tried to unpick in the final chapters of the book. Because what happens is we rapidly see multiple deaths in the family within short periods of time. Gurlukh Singh and his son, Nurnihal Singh, who was a strapping young man, die within about 17 months of Ranjit Singh's death under very mysterious circumstances, both of them. They fall out amongst themselves, father and son. And there's all sorts of conspiracy theories that the son was poisoning the dad and that the son was then murdered hand in glove by the prime minister, who was also trying to make a grab for power, Dhyan Singh. And then you see a civil war break out between Gurlukh Singh's wife, Maharani Chand Kaur, and Gurlukh Singh's half-brother, Prince Sher Singh, who was, to add confusion to the mix, the son of the Maharaja's first wife, but who may likely not have been Ranjit Singh's son, as it's thought that the first wife adopted two twin boys to kind of offset the claims of of the new baby Gurlukh Singh. So there's all this messiness. See, well,
it is a really involved story. No soap opera could come up with this.
No, know? Game of Thrones has nothing on the Punjab at this point in time. So it all gets really messy within the family, for one thing, and it creates this massive shock to the succession plans. But it's also, you know, how we understand the history of that period is also complicated, and a lot of it is lost to us because much less of kind of original Punjabi primary source material is not so widely available. And secondly, much more of this history has been written by British colonial officials at that time, and very much with a skewed agenda to really do down the heirs of Ranjit Singh and make them look bad, and also to justify increasing British intervention in the region. So what I try and do in those final chapters of the book is to unpick some of those layers within that history writing of that period, to read it against the grain and get to another sense of who these characters were, and particularly Ranjit Singh's eldest sons and the wives that take over at this point, and make sense of some of the contradictions that really appear actually in those colonial sources. Because it seems that in the early 1840s, many of these people were written about much more positively, even by company officers, then later on in the period when the two are at war. And that makes a lot of sense if you think about the politics of all of
yeah.
that.
Yes, it does.
And yeah, you end up with an increasingly hawkish British establishment that, having been to war in Afghanistan and wanting to take more control of the region, obviously the First War was a disaster, but then there's a real clamour to not only fight back and gain revenge against the Afghans, but also to bring as much as possible of the entire region under control. So you see Sindh, the emirs of Sindh, being taken over to the west of the Punjab. And then there's annexation going on in Burma. And then eventually there's a desire to either make sure that the Punjab is going to be an easy to manage buffer state between British India and the Afghans and the Russians, or whether it should just be taken over wholesale. And this all comes to a boil, really, in the reigns of the Maharani Chand Kaur and then Jind Kaur, the last kind of two powerful queens of the region, because there's many, many company officials that really don't like seeing women in power. And the Khalsa army in particular, the Sikh army that Ranjit Singh had really built up and fashioned, becomes increasingly unruly as well, as a result partly of these civil wars in which the members of the family are bribing different factions of the army against each other. They become the ultimate kingmakers, and the power over the government passes more and more from the army away from the royal family. But what's interesting, I think, in all of this is there was genuinely nothing inevitable that this kingdom was going to collapse. You know, even within British political opinion, or even within Punjabi political opinion, it's fascinating that the monarchy and the royal family is never, although different factions of it are played off against each other, it's not completely replaced. And even after the Second Anglo-Sikh War of 1848 to 49, there were key British officials, Henry Lawrence most prominently, who could have easily become a Governor General of the company had he not died in the 1850s. He was very keen for the Punjab to remain independent and for the boy Maharaja, Dalip Singh, to remain on the throne, but as a kind of a puppet Maharaja, a bit like you have with the Indian princes who become kind of indirectly ruled by their government after 1857.
We do finish every show on Afterwards by asking our guests about one source or text, be that a film, a book or otherwise, that influenced your book. So what was yours, Priya?
Oh my goodness.
Game of Thrones has already been mentioned.
You know what? I didn't really like Game of Thrones, so it won't be that. I think there's two, I think, that set the seed for this. One is the very first book I ever read on this topic, which was Empire of the Sikhs by Budwant Singh and Jyoti Rai. And I'd never heard of this. This is the sad thing. I'd never heard about this history at all growing up. But I attended a talk at the Sikh Society at university when I was in my first year. And it was because they were promoting this book. And it was a talk about the book. And it was the first time I'd heard about the Maharani and her struggles against the British Empire and this whole royal family. And I was just blown away, having grown up as a British Asian kid in Buckinghamshire, that how the hell did I not know this? And coming from a Sikh family. But before that, and I mentioned this on your history and film podcast, is a movie, and it was Jodha Akbar, the movie about the...
Yay!
about
we are both obsessive fans of.
So I'd seen that, I think, the summer before I went to university. So I was primed and ready to then receive this information and just be mind blown that actually there was a Sikh version of this kind of empire. And oh my God, I need to know about more about this. So yeah, if ever I can make a movie of this one day, I still want to get Hrithik Roshan and Aishwarya Rai and various other Punjabi actors to be part of it. Could you imagine?
It'd be amazing. I want to watch. Thank you so much, Priya Rajwal, for taking part in this episode. Afterwards is produced by George McDonough, and you can buy a copy of Royals and Rebels from the Hearst Publishers website. I suggest you do so right now. For more, follow us on Twitter, Hearst at Hearst Publishers, Priya at Priya Atwal, and me at Alex V. Tunzelman. And to get news on the latest Hearst books, subscribe to email updates at hearstpublishers.com. I'm Alex von Tunzelman. Thank you for listening.